Hey, everybody. Welcome to Roger and Me, a.k.a. Roger Ebert and Me, for search engine optimization purposes. We are a podcast that reviews every new movie that comes out every Friday. We aim to do that at the podcast. I would say Mark Dusick, my co-host of MarkReviewsMovies.com. He is much more thorough, does a much better job of catching all the movies that come out every Friday. This week, I think Mark has, 11 movies up on MarkReviewsMovies.com. At least 11. I feel like there might actually be 12.
I think there's 12.
I realize the Cowboy one isn't on there. So that's 12. On this podcast today, a very reasonable 6. Maybe
I'm not complaining.
No.
This is nice.
One of the fewest I feel like we've ever covered. And before I crammed a couple more this morning, it was going to be 4. So I really stretched shit out to make it 6. My name is Brett Arnold at Brett Redacted on ElonMusk'sX.com. That's how you get there now, I think. I want to say a happy birthday to us. Mark had a birthday this week. I had a birthday this week. Is it Happy's birthday? Like attorneys general? Is that what I should say?
Happy birthdays? It's happy birthdays because the noun is birthday.
That's very reasonable. I'm going to stick with Happy's birthday to us.
It sounds fun.
At the Roger Ebert and Me podcast. We call ourselves that because it's a tribute to Siskel and Ebert. There was one part of this show when we first started. There was a component where we did watch Siskel and Ebert every week and reviewed the movies that they talked about 40 years ago, 30 years ago. But who has the time to do all that? We barely have time to watch all the movies that come out every damn week because there are so many. We're often in the double digits here at the show. So we are basking in the 6 that we have to talk about this week. So let's not waste any more time. Let's get right into it. The biggest release of the week has to be A Haunting in Venice. The third Kenneth Branagh, Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie mystery whodunit. This one's called A Haunting in Venice. The last one was called Death on the Nile, which you may remember from the Gal Gadot trailer meme, Enough Champagne to Fill the Nile, if you don't remember the film. Pretty forgettable affair. And the first one that was a surprise hit that started this whole thing was Murder on the Orient Express. So now we have a third. It is horror tinged. It is set in Venice. It is shot on location to a degree. It is shot in Italy, I think. Not as much green screen, or at least not as much noticeable green screen or CGI in this one. Fans of Death of the Nile, or I guess not fans of that movie, will know what I'm talking about. Here's a trailer for A Haunting in Venice.
Hercule Poirot, I've found something. I've looked at it from every which way. I am the smartest person I ever met, and I can't figure it out, so I came to the second.
You are up to something, my friend.
I've seen a million of these so-called psychics, each one a fake.
I do not believe in psychics.
Come with me to a seance. Spot the con I can't.
Detective, you are here to discredit me, but I can talk to the dead.
All I have to hear my daughter's voice.
If someone wants to be heard, we are here. Listening.
Wow. What a trailer. Mark, tell me about A Haunting in Venice.
It is Kenneth Branagh's third Hercule Poirot adaptation. And I like Murder on the Orient Express. I definitely was not a fan of Death on the Nile. You're right. The green screen work was atrocious.
The funniest thing about that is I saw that movie. I don't know if you did. The press screening for Death on the Nile was on 70 millimeter film. So it was particularly hilarious to watch the most green screen CGI ridden background movie on film. Like, what are we doing here?
That sounds terrible. So I was hoping for something a little bit different, and you know, Haunting in Venice pares everything down. It is mostly like a single set. It's a big manor in Venice, and there's some happenings and some shenanigans and a couple of mysteries. I think there's 3 murders over the course of this movie that need to be solved. And I'm of a mixed mind on it because it really leans into the atmosphere, this pseudo horror sort of atmosphere. It's a ghost story potentially. It is this creepy potential, you know, presence in the house that could be causing these deaths.
Yes, there's or a supernatural layer on this one that did not exist in the other two.
Yeah. So I was kind of a fan of that, but then the question is how much of the rest of the stuff that I liked from, say, you know, Orient Express carries over into this. That's where it's kind of the mixed bag stuff. It doesn't, I miss some of the character work. There are fewer characters in this one. The cast is fine. It is not up to the level of the past two movies. You don't have huge names. There are some big names, but they're not huge names. Like, I'm trying to think of even like just everybody within Murder on the Orient Express.
It feels like second build in this movie is Tina Fey, who like arguably is a TV actress and a star. I mean, I know she's been in plenty of movies and had her time, but to me, she's like, you know, 30 Rock. And I would say she stands out like a sore thumb to me in this movie. Is that the time period factor or is that her performance or is it both those things? But I feel like, go ahead. Sorry.
No. I think it might be both of those things. I think she's playing up a 1940s mystery writer character. She's playing that up a bit too much.
It's like a sketch comedy version of that character, which is like, you know, her bread and butter, and maybe not what you want in a movie like this that's trying to be like just an actual whodunit with a detective in the center. Where like Knives Out is that, but like takes the piss out of it, kind of, right? Like it's kind of a send up of that. This is just supposed to be that, like Agatha Christie mystery. And yeah, this one is lacking in that department. And I know this is based on a short story called what, Halloween Night or something by Agatha Christie?
Halloween Party, I think. Yes. Is what it is. It's like one of her later ones. So it's not well known.
It's not supposed to be one of her best. Yeah.
And I like that. I like that he's pulling from, you know, a lesser known book, because I didn't know where this was going. Apparently he made some changes too, but yes, I still didn't know where it was gonna go.
Apparently there's not like a supernatural bend to the Halloween Party story despite the title, but yeah, the movie does have that layer. And just in terms of like I actually found the mystery part of Death of the Nile, I mean, of course it should work because it's Agatha Christie, so like I thought that the reveal of that one was like good enough, and I gave the movie
too.
Like a 2.5 pass or something. And like, I desperately just want to be surprised by the mystery of these movies. That's what I'm there for. It's a whodunit. The movie's supposed to misdirect you, and you're supposed to be smarter than it and try to figure it out. But hopefully, the movie's smarter than you are. And like with this one, I'm just like, I don't know if it was. I'm not saying I'm a genius for figuring this movie out. I'm saying that the script isn't very like. It doesn't obfuscate what's happening enough. It's just like, this is the setup. Here's what's happening. What do you think? And the first thought I had ended up being like partially correct. Like it wasn't the entire kit and caboodle was like, this character's doing everything. But the way it all came together, it just didn't satisfy in the way that a whodunit needs to satisfy. And there's also like the, I don't think Kenneth Branagh's a very good director thing going on, where like, this movie has atmosphere and it definitely oozes style, but like the man does not have, I don't think he has a style. His style is I'm going to put the camera in wacky places. And every time we cut away, it's going to be a different canted angle or a fisheye lens or something that doesn't have any rhyme or reason. It's not like you're watching that going, great shot selection. I really understand why the camera was doing that. It doesn't feel expressionistic in a way that I want it to. Do you feel that way too?
I bought into the whole, I bought into all the Dutch angles. I bought into the weird just compositions that are going on. Like there's a shot of him and Faye in a spiral staircase and it's all really tight and everything. I thought some of that stuff was neat. I think Branagh can be a fine stylist. I like Dead Again is great. This has sort of tones of Dead Again.
I feel like everyone is referencing Dead Again in their reviews of this movie because they're like, that's what I wanted from this, was like more actual horror trappings. I don't know. This feels like it's like too austere or something, or too jump scary for me. Like all the horror amounts to just like characters walking in and you think it's like, you know, it's a lot of the, oh, I didn't see you there type of surprise. Or like a cat walks by type of shit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, there is. Yeah, there is that stuff to it. It's a little distracting from the mystery, but it also I didn't quite care because it does have this distinct tone and this distinct voice and this distinct look. You're like this. He is just trying to channel this old fashioned horror movie while the murder mystery is playing out. Yeah. And I appreciated that fact, especially after Death on the Nile, which just really felt like it had no personality, no voice because of all the green screen work, because just having so many characters and all of that in it. Narrowing it down, I was able to focus a bit more on the performances, which I think apart from Faye are pretty good. Kelly Riley is really good here. She's a grieving mother. That's like the first mysterious death that happened before the movie starts.
Yeah.
Jamie Dornan is really good as a shell-shocked war veteran who's a doctor and trying just to get by the day. Michelle Yeoh plays
she's great.
The psychic. She's yeah. fantastic. There's this yeah. level of melancholy to her that you don't expect. She either does talk to the dead or she believes she talks to the dead enough that it really has affected her, and you can see all of that. It's yeah, I think the performances here, apart from, you know, a couple, are really good. I bought into the atmosphere and I bought into some of the performances. But I think you're right. The mystery is lacking here. It feels a bit rushed, especially near the end. Everything seems to kind of resolve itself. And then it's like, oh, wait, no, we need more. We need more. And yeah. all that happens. Yeah. And then there's like just suddenly that is solved. And you're like, OK, I guess it just feels like deflection and distraction. I was disappointed in the mystery of it.
Which is the whole kit and caboodle as far as exactly. I'm concerned. That's why I walked away so disappointed with it, I think. And yeah, Tina Fey definitely stands out as like, I just don't buy her as a 1940s person somehow. Like, I don't know if it's her performance or just that fact that fundamentally it's not going to work. But yeah, the mystery doesn't work. There's this weird quality to the movie that kind of began, and I think it was Death in the Nile that it began, where he had like the origin story of his mustache scene, where like there's so much backstory added to this for every character, and like arguably you go, that's good, I want characters to have some meat on the bone. But in this murder mystery thing, it just ends up feeling like we don't really know that many of the characters, and what we do know is all this melodrama that is just death obsessed in a way that I didn't find like horror movie compelling. It was just kind of like piling on trauma backstory in a way that by like the third character that to relearn that had this tragic backstory, I'm like, I get it, everyone has their own serious narrative that makes them feel how they feel about death or whatever. It's just all, I feel like it's not as fun as it should be. Like when the movie is fun, it's when it isn't doing that stuff, and when it's actually having fun with Perot and whatnot. And I feel like it, you know, it ends where it should have began, maybe, in terms of like this movie starts with Perot not wanting to be Perot anymore and not wanting to do that, which like classic sequel stuff, that's fine. But I don't know. I just think there's like a disconnect between what I want from these movies and what Kenneth Branagh wants from this character and how he treats the character like he's this amazing, it's like superhero movie type of thing. And I'm over it. Every time I watch one of these, I go, that was fine, and I walk away from it. This one, I walked away a little more disappointed because I should have liked it more because it's a horror movie. And I felt like all the horror things were flourishes that didn't add a lot, even though I agree, like the production design of the mansion is cool and like horror, Hammer horror-esque. But yeah, it's ultimately disappointing. It didn't do a lot for me. Had the mystery been more compelling, I would be singing a different tune probably, but it's very just kind of, well, that's what happened. And I'm like, okay. It just didn't feel like it even had some, you know, big message to it where I feel like the other ones really tried harder in that department. 2 stars for me on A Haunting in Venice.
Slightly more positive, 2.5. I'm still not quite recommending it, but again, the atmosphere got me. I think Branagh does a better job playing the more playful side of Poirot this time around. That was one of the things that Death on the Nile, you're right, that whole origin story, the mustache, and just how dejected and defeated he is throughout the whole movie.
Yeah, that self-seriousness is what still carried through here, and those are the things I don't appreciate. Because like I feel like there is such schlocky fun to be had, and like the stuff with Michelle Yeoh is so fun, and then whatever happens, and then the more movie happens, and I was less interested in that, you know?
Yeah.
So ultimately disappointing.
I agree it's disappointing, but I did have a little bit more fun with the style of it, I think, than you did. So,
yeah. And you know what? My co-hosts on the New Flesh podcast, where we're obviously covering it, because it's enough of a horror-adjacent film that we're going to cover it on the main feed. He really liked it. Jesse Hassinger, my co-host there. So don't let me dissuade you. If you're, you know, a Poirot fan or a horror fan and you wanted to see it, maybe it'll work for you. I'm a tough critic when it comes to horror stuff that's a little mainstream, where most people will probably think it's fine, and I'm just crossing my arms like, this isn't real horror. So, grain of salt. Here's the next film. It's in very limited release this week. Goes wider next week, and I think even wider the week after that. Very classic, a new classic strategy from Sony, who did this with Gran Turismo, I feel like. Dumb Money, the movie about the GameStop short stocking, short squeeze. I said it wrong. I'm trying to say, yeah, short stock. Stocking isn't the word I was looking for. It's not Christmas related. The stock squeeze that happened around GameStop when like Redditors went against Wall Street, who bet against GameStop with shorts and whatnot. The movie explains it better. Here's the trailer.
Holy fucking shit.
I will tell you, I've never seen anything like it.
Holy fucking shit.
It's the craziest I think I've ever seen.
Everything okay?
$11 fucking million. What are you gonna do? Get a Ferrari? What the fuck?
Oh, language. The baby's here.
Ooh. Yo, what up, everybody? Roy and Kitty here. I'm gonna pick a stock and talk about why I think it's interesting, and that stock is GameStop.
I love this guy.
Retail traders have hooked into GameStop.
I think they think it's a good investment. It looks like there's one guy driving all the buying.
Who is this schmuck?
Dumb Money, man.
Happy to take it.
Wall Street is betting that this company is going to fail. Because if it fails, these hedge fund assholes make a shit ton of money. 70,000 people have watched this video.
Rory City, I love you!
Mark, I think they shouldn't be allowed to make movies that are period pieces about a period that was 2.5, less than 3 years ago. What do you think?
Yeah, it's weird to think that WAP is suddenly a period song, like in terms of like,
I know.
Remember that song from 2021? Like 2 years ago?
Yeah, and this is way beside the point, because that is exactly what that moment is doing, is trying to bring you back to that time. But then there's a montage featuring a Kendrick Lamar song as if it had come out during that era. I feel like everyone was doing a little TikTok song to it or whatever. And that song came out in 2017. So that made me confused. And I was like, well, this period piece is falling apart rapidly. And that's maybe the problem with just like rushing one of these out. I think inherently, maybe because we've been trained by a lot of streaming TV era things to think of stuff like this as streaming TV fodder. So the movie never really rises above feeling like a rushed to Hulu documentary docudrama about this thing that happened 2 years ago. But please tell me what it's about, in case people were under a rock 2 years ago.
Yeah. So it was about the short squeeze attempt from people online on Reddit and YouTube and Twitter and all that, when it was still Twitter. Oh, remember those days?
Yeah. Anyway, I was here. That's what I mean. I was there. I saw all of this too.
We all were there. We remembered all this stuff. We were keeping track of it because we were all shut in our houses. There wasn't much else to do, so we were paying attention to this stuff. This feels like they took a documentary about this and threw some actors in to plugged in to like the recreation scenes from this. It doesn't it explains everything really well. It explains how all of it happened and what happened specifically. I get all of that. And I mean, that's an accomplishment to some degree to explain the entire idea of shorting stocks, what these hedge funds would do, even though, you know, we know a lot of it from The Big Short, but beyond all of that, how, you know, just a guy on YouTube can get people so excited about a company that everybody thought failed. I really thought everybody hated GameStop well before people were, you know, shorting the stocks on it. But, you know, whatever. We understand all of it. And that's about it. I'm missing the human element here. There are a lot of characters. There are a lot of characters. I will give it that much. There's a lot of people. There are like two college students who are in debt. There's this nurse who's going through the whole COVID-19 pandemic and treating people who's also in debt. There's a guy who works at a GameStop store who is, you know, just trying to get work hours because they're reduced. All of that is there, but those characters don't exist. They're just there to kind of explain exactly what's going on, as is Paul Dano's character, aka Roaring Kitty, on YouTube, and all the hedge fund guys. They're just there to explain everything that is going on. I never got a sense of personality from any of them.
I would argue there's one person who gets to have personality, and I feel like he's polarizing. Either you're gonna think Pete Davidson is funny here, or you're gonna be annoyed. And I think I'm a little of both. I don't have a problem with him. I laugh at the very inspired casting of Pete Davidson as a stoner who lives in his parents' basement. Where'd they get that idea? Crazy idea. But, you know, he is like the heart of the movie, weirdly, and gets all the laughs and like all the arc are belong to him, it feels like. So you're right. I agree with you. It does lack a human element despite having a huge cast and like an ensemble that jumps from person to person. But they don't really interconnect in the way that they obviously do, that they're all buying stock and hoping that this thing works for them. But yeah, it just feels like it never rises above the by the numbers approach of you're watching a thing that happened play out the way that it happened. And if you're like me and Mark, who were on Twitter at this time, you probably know all those beats anyway. But like, there's something to the crowd pleasing nature of this, right, Mark? Like the working class antidote to the corporate worship movies we've been getting that are like, aren't corporations great? This one's like, aren't corporations and rich people awful? And isn't it great that the, you know, working class people had a chance to maybe tip the scales a little bit? But, you know, the ultimate, I mean, spoiler alert, I guess, for like recent history, but like, you'll realize that the game still ends up being rigged for the rich, and the poor people mostly still lose. Like, there's a very short window where people could have gotten rich in this thing, and it did happen to some people for sure. But there's also the characters that you see that it didn't work out for them, and now it's just over. I appreciate that, you know, it goes ooh-rah, fuck the rich, but all that stuff, isn't it all too cartoonish kind of in the movie? And like, I know it's real life. Like, the guy did have a pig running around his house when he was doing this, allegedly. Like, these are all real things, real grace note details. But when you present them in the movie, it just really becomes like a pretty cartoonish, like these evil rich fucking idiots who, I think Seth Rogen, you see him at the beginning. He's like, you think he's preparing to like build a house, but you realize he's actually trying to just tear down a house to build himself a tennis court, which is just like a metaphor for the whole movie that's happening right before you. It all just is a little on the nose and surface level for me. But again, I thought it was totally watchable, inoffensive. I knew everything that occurred in it because I was on the internet at the time. So it wasn't like new information to me. I feel like if you weren't online at the time, I think this would be worth recommending as like a, yeah, if you have no idea what I'm talking about when I say the GameStop short squeeze, this is a fine movie that explains it. I just don't know if that needed to exist. And all these movies are just trying to be The Social Network. So even though I'm saying it's like an antidote to that corporate worship subgenre, doesn't the outline of the movie, isn't it at all the same? It still feels like it's the same movie. There's not that much distance between them.
Between this and The Social Network, or this and all those corporate worship movies that we've been seeing?
Yeah, that. All of them. All of them.
Oh, okay. Got it. yeah, there's not much distance between those two things. I also think the movie doesn't, I don't think there's enough distance time-wise for this movie to really exist. It just sort of ends, and it doesn't really have any message to it because we're still living through the aftermath of this. We're living through the immediate aftermath of what happened. We don't know how it's going to really play out. We're still, you know, we don't know. It doesn't have anything to tell us except that this stuff happened. Isn't that funny that this stuff happened?
Exactly. There hasn't been enough time to like ruminate on what this means for the society and the world or anything. It's just kind of like, yeah, this happened, and we can only portray it in the most basic of terms, which like everyone will agree with, which is like, there's this, you know, the system is rigged. It's not fair. The working class people get screwed. The rich have bailouts that will protect them, while we, the working class, get none of that protection and will wind up screwed. And if you try to fuck with the system, you'll end up hauled before a congressional committee. You know what I mean? So like, even though it is crowd pleasing, like it does, I appreciate that it's crowd pleasing at the same time as it's like the opposite of wistful, I guess, about this type of stuff. Like, it's kind of realistically hard nosed about it, and I appreciate that, but it doesn't mean like I thought the movie was a great time. Like, I'm just watching, it's a lot of watching people post online, and it's a lot of memes, and it's a lot of references that I feel like will go over most audiences' heads, because you're like, why are they talking about tendies so much? And you're just like, yeah, I don't know. These, and it also glosses over, but makes mention of, but glosses over the like horrific misogynist assholey Reddit part of the story, which exists and is a part of it. The movie kind of goes, yeah, those people exist online everywhere, so who cares? We're not going to focus on it. I didn't hate the movie. I think I liked it more than you, because I'm going to give it 2.5.
But okay, yeah.
I walked away going, it's fine. I don't know what I'm supposed to walk away from and feel like. Should we all go do this again? Should we go short squeeze some other stock that the Wall Street thinks is going to fail and just do this again? It feels like it. Yeah, I don't know. Give me an instruction manual when I leave this movie. I want to know what I'm supposed to do.
Give me something other than, hey, this happened. This guy had a big speech where he explained everything to Congress, and then, but we already watched everybody explain everything before that. That was it's a very anticlimactic moment to have the big speech of everything, of summarizing everything that we've already seen. I'm less enthusiastic about it. 2 stars.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what, like, a lot of, I feel like it premiered at a film festival, so a lot of critics thought it was better than it was thing going on. Yeah, I saw it the same day, and a lot of people were at the festival. It got a much higher rating than everywhere else. So I feel like it must have played really well in that room. And I get that. It feels like it would play good in a room because it's a crowd pleasing movie. And I did see it in a screening room. There just wasn't that many people in it. But, you know, it's also kind of disingenuous about the movement of it all. And, you know, it just sandpapers off the edges and makes it a nice story for a movie. And, you know, there are better movies that tackle similar subjects. It's fine. It was totally fine. That's my walk away. 2.5 stars. Better than I thought it would be, probably. Like, it's totally watchable. That's like the damnedest thing I could say about it. It's like, it's watchable.
I was able to observe it with my eyes.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I took in the information. I think I got it. All right. Next movie is on Netflix now. Haley Lou Richardson and some guy in Love at First Sight. Sorry to this man. I don't know who you are, but I know Haley.
It's Ben Hardy. I will say it.
Ben Hardy.
Because he's good in this movie.
He is good. He's very charming. Yeah, there we go. So is Haley. He has to match Haley Lou's charm.
Yeah, I know. That's
and he does. Oh, so it's good.
We're getting ahead of ourselves here. Sorry. Oh, yeah. That was me.
Love at First Sight.
On a typical day at John F. Kennedy Airport, there are thousands of people going hundreds of places.
Excuse me. Sorry.
My battery keeps dying.
I'll borrow mine if you want.
But today, a girl and a boy will meet.
Sorry, I don't share electronics till the third date.
Okay. No, I suppose it is quite intimate.
And it will change everything. Over the next 6 hours and 47 minutes, Hadley Sullivan and Oliver Jones will fall in love.
This is me.
Well, this is unexpected.
I've always hated airplanes.
Then why are you on a 7-hour flight to London?
A wedding. You?
It's a bit complicated. Have you ever had
outside.
Do you want to join me at the cinema? Make our first date dinner and a cheesy rom-com? Or is that like a third date thing for you?
I'll be reaching for you.
Breaking all my rules for you.
The odds of finding your soulmate are slim to none.
This is my number. Text me so I've got yours.
Oh, no.
The odds of finding them again. Good luck.
I wasn't expecting to enjoy this as much as I did, Mark, but it's quite charming. And I think it's deliberate, like old fashioned nature. And the fact that it's not some like sarcastic, irony filled rom-com, the fact that it's just earnestly a very corny, hokey, fate will save you in the end, romantic comedy totally works in its favor, even if it's very familiar. Everything it's doing, other movies have done.
Yeah, there's a formula to these things, and this follows it. You pretty much know exactly where this is going to end when you start watching the movie, but it leans into that. It is all about fate and destiny and whether or not it exists, and there's coincidences, or any of this stuff is going on, and that's playing out in the background, and it sounds cheesy, but it doesn't play out that way, because it really introduces you to these characters. You get to know them on some very basic but worthwhile levels. Like, it goes through their base, their histories, like their top three fears and what happened in their lives to make them like reevaluate everything about their own life. So Haley Lou Richardson's character, her parents got divorced, so she's, you know, skeptical about everything. Ben Hardy, his character's name's Oliver. I was about to say Oliver Hardy. That's somebody else entirely. But yeah. Ben Hardy's character has, you know, got a scare from a health issue in his family. And so now he is trying to figure out exactly, you know, the probability of everything happening and making sure, trying to find some order in life in the world just so he can feel comfortable as much as he can about it. I liked both of them, not just because Richardson and Hardy are both really good and really charming here, but I like the characters on a fundamental level. I understood them and I sympathize with them and I related to them. Like, that's really all you need for a romantic comedy to work. But that whole added level of fate and destiny. So you have Jameela Jamil showing up as these different characters, kind of guiding them along the way,
yeah,
or commenting on what's going on and explaining why these important moments are important, not only for their love story, but also to them. I bought into it. I know it's 100%. Cheesy. 100%. I bought into it entirely.
I totally did too. And I don't know if this is the best comparison, but like that specific conceit of like a character being fate and just being all the different background characters, I know I've seen it before in a movie,
yeah,
in several movies, and I can't name them. The one that comes to mind is like A Matter of Life and Death or something, where it's like, you know, angels from above having affairs on earth type of thing. It reminded me like of a 1940s rom-com or a romantic movie. I guess you wouldn't even call those rom-coms. They were just like romantic movies. So like, I appreciated that it's pulling from really old stuff to just be as earnest as it is. Yeah, we're just a romantic comedy that has a formula. We're going to follow that formula, but you're still going to have a good time despite all that. And it works. And I think it's genuinely charming. The two performances, the dialogue is genuinely cute and funny. And you just believe the situation that they're in. And like when she rushes away from the wedding to go find him, it's actually like a funny situation that they've put themselves, the movie has written itself into, where, you know, she thinks she's going to a memorial, but maybe it's not something so, maybe it is that, but maybe it's something a little different. And I just appreciated that it was like this fun 90 minute little movie that never overstayed its welcome. I never checked my watch. I just was totally with it watching Haley Lou Richardson, you know, fall in love with this guy as Jameela Jamil tells me statistics about love and fate and how people know each other in the world and stuff. And it, you know, it is hokey. I feel like 500 Days of Summer also had a weird fixation on like stats or numbers and stuff like that. And it just, again, it's just pulling from other movies, doing what they do and saying, I bet we could do that too, because we have two charming people in the lead. So won't you watch? And I think that's fine. Like there's stuff like this comes out every week on Netflix and arguably on Hallmark. And like, there's not that much, you know, distance between this and a Hallmark movie, I feel like. But why does this work in like a Hallmark movie not? Like, does that make any sense?
Yeah, I think it is the level of earnestness. It's not being ironic about any of this. It genuinely cares about the characters, and it cares about them getting together and why they would get together and the reasons why maybe they would be apart beyond the circumstances that are going on. There's some good character work here. I wasn't expecting that, but it's there and it pays off so that when, you know, if you would think like the ending to this movie shows up earlier and it doesn't because one of the characters is like, I can't deal with this right now because of everything else going on in my life. And that makes total sense.
Yeah.
Like that happens.
Just very real. Yeah.
And you just believe it. It creates this world. Yeah. It's pulling from different elements from different movies and just the whole formula of it. But it creates this entire world of fate and destiny and these two people just trying to meet up again and trying to find each other and all the problems that arise from that. And you buy it. And I bought it and I liked it. And that's as simple as it can be. It's totally worth checking out, even if you're not a fan of rom-coms, I think.
It's
just a sweet, charming movie.
My wife likes Serendipity a lot. And I'm like, this is probably that movie, like the same movie, but just, you know, with more modern references or whatever. It's not dissimilar from any other rom-com that has a similar premise about fate and love. But it's very good. And like when she says she just wants someone to, you know, to hold her hand through life when things get rough, like right after they held hands through turbulence on an airplane.
Yeah.
You're like, this movie is kind of clever about what it's doing. Like it's better than you'd think with a Netflix, movie of the week style release. It's good. Solid 3 stars for Love at First Sight. It was.
Yes.
I very much enjoyed it.
Yeah, solid 3 stars for me too. Just definitely check it out. Again, if you're skeptical of these things, either because it's Netflix or because it's a rom-com, I think it's worth your time.
Totally agree.
Surprising.
Totally agree. This next one, limited release this week, going wider the week after that, I believe. This is a movie directed by Adil El Arbi and Bilal Fallah. I believe they're Belgian filmmakers, the guys who made Bad Boys for Life, the third Bad Boys movie, and they just directed Batgirl, which doesn't exist. The movie that Warner Brothers like wiped off the face of the earth that starred Brendan Fraser and Michael Keaton and Batgirl. Movie doesn't exist, but this movie does. It's called Rebel. Here's the trailer.
Une célébrité locale.
Sola, sola.
L'été dernier, il s'est rendu en Syrie comme agent humanitaire.
Tu es mon fils. Je t'aime.
Je vais partir un petit moment, petit frère.
Regarde.
Calme-toi, Abou Bakr al-Baljiki. Le trafic m'a dit. Et dans ton oeil, tu as des choses. Nassim, choses frères. Amusim.
Oui, Kamel, on se parle régulièrement.
Il est où?
Je peux pas dire exactement, tu vois, parce que là, c'est une zone de guerre là-bas.
Aïe! Phil! T'as compris, tu files!
T'es واحد منهم. T'as vu le مصايب?
I'm just trying to survive. Thank you.
Mark, walk me through this very harrowing premise. Rebel.
Yeah, so it is about a family of three in Brussels. It opens with it. You find out the elder brother is in the Islamic State in ISIS and has taken part in an execution. And from there, you dig into the past of this family and these characters and how he ended up in Syria as part of the Islamic State. And it is not at all what you would expect to happen based on that footage. And that's the thing I really appreciate about this film is that it takes the time to dive into these characters' past to say, just because you see something in one way doesn't mean that that's accurate. Because that is the whole reason that this guy ends up in Syria is that he's living in Brussels as an Arabic man with a family from Morocco, and he has been targeted by police. He's facing prejudice just across the entire scope of his life. And he doesn't feel like he's accomplishing anything because he doesn't have any opportunities because of all that. So when the civil war is escalating in Syria, he's seeing all of it. He's like, I'm going to go there and I'm going to do something good. I'm going to help out people because they need help. And because of that, he ends up getting involved in the Islamic State. And it has nothing to do with a choice that he makes. It's all out of fear and coercion and threats of death. It's harrowing. I was totally invested in that story. But then the fact the film adds to it and you follow the younger brother as he's being influenced at home in Brussels by someone to follow in his brother's footsteps, the alleged footsteps of his brother, and to become a religious fanatic based off of that. It's devastating, and it feels so realistic and simple in the way that these groups, and it's not just the Islamic State, and it's not just one religion. It's anything. We have tons of examples throughout history. We have tons of examples, even just recent history of people being caught up in something like this, that maybe they don't necessarily believe in it, but they believe in some angle of it, and they will follow a group or a single person to extreme ends just because of that. I think we need to understand this stuff. I think we need to understand how all this happens. And this film shows you in believable detail how something like this could happen and how it doesn't mean that the people who become involved in it are necessarily wrong.
That's what's, I think a lot of people, some people, I think I've already seen this when I was scrolling through Letterboxd, but like some people are just going to reject this movie's premise right away because it's not whitewashed. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This is a movie that shows you how radicalization actually works from the perspective of someone who might be radicalized, who is susceptible to it, even though they're a sympathetic person. And that's the part that I think a lot of people are going to get hung up on. They're like, why should I have sympathy for this fucking ISIS fighter? And that's why the movie's really is good, is because it makes you understand why someone would end up in this position, where it sounds crazy to be like, oh yeah, that movie that's like made me sympathize for an ISIS fighter was really good, but it's true. And I'm simplifying it. Like, that's not exactly what it's doing, but I think a lot of people will watch it and take away that and be like pissed at it or something. But I agree with you completely. I thought it was really strong, and the movie makes the radicalization seem so reasonable, right? Like, you're fighting against Bashar al-Assad, the most fucking evil leader of a country ever, who is bombing and gassing his own people. So you think that like rising up against that is the right thing to do. But then you see how ISIS uses that situation to trick people into, you know, doing terrorism and fighting for worse causes, and how then they use you to, you know, get your brother over there. It's just, yeah, you're right. It's hard to watch in like a, you feel like you're watching like a exploitation movie. It has that quality to it. But I don't know, Mark, I liked it. I'm definitely going to be on the 3-star side, but I'm going to, you're on the 3.5-star side. I will spoil here. You really like this movie, and I'm more on the maybe 2.5-3 side. If only, I'm still 3, but like I say that only to say there's something about the degree to which it goes in the end, I will say, where I just felt like a little melodrama, maybe taken a little far for theatrical maximum effect reasons, that took away from the message for me a little bit. It just felt like it got really heavy hand. I mean, it's heavy stuff, but like it's heavy handed in a way that, you know, occasionally it's like these guys are action movie guys, so the action's fairly compelling and well done. And you could argue like maybe this takes glee in that misery or wallows in it. But for me, it wasn't that. It was more that like the choice felt kind of corny in the end, where I feel like everything else was really earnestly done. I feel like there was like a grace note at the end that was supposed to be like the big emotional, like wreck you point, that to me was like a bridge too far, like a little corny story wise to make your point. You know what I mean? Do you understand that?
I kind of do, but I saw it as just the only logical end for this story. I was so invested in the characters and how all of this happens, and seeing that as so simple and so easy that there was really only one logical way for the movie to end. But when it happens, it still hit me because of course this is how it's going to happen. The reaction to it from another character, I'm not going to say anything specific about it, but that reaction from that other character,
it's tough.
Is so, the conflict going on just in that moment is so powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I hear you. If I had another note that kept me on the teetering edge to three, it was that, like, there are expressionistic bursts of, like, musical numbers that happened through a couple times. I would say there's one actual, like, musical sequence, and then a couple, like, the dude's a rapper, so there's a couple rapping sequences too. And, like, I get why they're there, and I, like, appreciate them on paper, Mark, but when they're happening, I was like, okay. Like, it just felt like if you're going to do this mode, maybe the whole movie should be in this mode rather than there's like two bursts where it goes into musical numbers and you're kind of left scratching your head as to if the movie's going to keep doing that. But I get it. So I'm not super mad at it. I just want to, did you think that was like a nice grace note, or did you also go, oh, okay, I could do without
that? It's different. It's different. I do appreciate the fact they embrace that level of style to make it subjective, because everything else in the movie is so objective. It's like, this is how it's going to happen. These are what these characters are going through. So to have those moments of just the characters opening up in a way that they can't. It's otherwise.
It's a release for the characters, which is why I'll allow it. You know what I mean? Even though I was like, yeah, I don't know if the movie's long also. It's like 2 hours and 15 minutes or something. So like all those moments, it's like me checking my watch territory, unfortunately. But like, I get it. I get why it's there. And you're right. Like, if I like this movie more, I would be like, those moments are so beautiful, I'm sure. But like, because I didn't love it, I'm just like, this is quizzical of everything. But I think it's ultimately a good movie that is important. There's something I feel like I'm crashing up against where I'm like, it's not dissimilar from like a Sound of Freedom in like the type of movie that it is, in terms of like trying to like call awareness on an issue. And I guess I appreciate that this doesn't end with the QR code telling me that it's Uncle Tom's Cabin for the 21st century or whatever. But is that an interesting comparison or not? I don't know.
Kind of, but yeah. This has a much stronger sense of style.
Yeah, I totally agree.
It has a much better hold on it, grasp on its characters and what it's trying to say, I think, that Sound of Freedom did. But I kind of see that it is, you know, ripped from the headlines
movies about real life issues that like are arguably like harrowing and people don't want to watch or hear about. Like, yeah, it's the same kind of genre. I do agree this is 100% the stronger movie of the two of them. But I mean, come on, right wing people, get on it. Make a campaign to get people to see this movie. Let's get those box office numbers up. Let's see if we can get $100 million to Rebel at the box office. Yeah, really strong. A lot of strong stuff in here. I'm sticking with my 3 stars, and I spoiled Mark's 3.5, but
that's fine. Yeah, 3.5. Yep, that's it. I think this is definitely worth checking out. It is, I think, New York this week, and then I think the wide expansion is just LA, but I don't know if they have plans for more, but it'll be digital release at some point if you're not in either of those two cities, or if you are in those two cities, go check it out. Maybe everybody else in the country will be able to see it in a theater. Who knows? Let's find out. It's really, really good.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking, authentic, really makes you, you know, you see the lack of resources that allow this type of shit to happen, or the fact that the government might be incentivized to not care that Arabs in their region are getting sent over there. Like, yeah, it's asks a lot of uncomfortable. It presents a lot of uncomfortable truths and doesn't really care if you're offended by it. And I appreciate that. All right, let's talk about this next movie. I saw this at Sundance in January, and I did not rewatch it. And Mark just saw it, so I'm going to be leaning on Mark when we talk about Cassandro, a wrestling luchador queer film starring Gael Garcia Bernal. Here's the trailer.
Hey, Papa. He introduced me to Lucha Libre. Took me to a few matches.
You don't see him no more?
El luchador?
Si.
Ay, mijo, tú tan haciendo.
I've been doing real fights since a couple of years ago.
Yeah, with Cast is a rock.
They don't see nothing else.
¿Estás preocupado?
You ever thought about being an exotico?
They don't let exoticos win. I want to flip it.
Mi voz puede volar, puede atravesar
Things are going to be a little different tonight. This guy right here is an exotico.
Stop wasting my time.
Digo, a mí no me importa que sea del otro bando. Pero ¿por qué no lo tiene que estar restregando en la jeta?
Pushing things. The other wrestlers think you're getting too big.
All right, Mark, tell me about Cassandra.
It is based on a true story, and I appreciate the fact that it doesn't make a big deal out of the fact that it's based on a true story. This is a real luchador. He was an American citizen who traveled down to Juarez to participate in Lucha Libre matches and gradually became famous after dropping the whole gimmick with the mask and becoming an exotico, which is essentially a not quite a heel, but sort of a heel if you're homophobic. And this takes place in the late 80s and early 90s, and so there's a lot of homophobia going on in the crowd. You know, you have characters dressed up in more flamboyant, more feminine type clothing and putting on a big show, and a lot of the crowd hates it. But his character wants to be the first one really to win a match and to show off talent and be who he is in the ring, who he can't be in real life. It's a really interesting dichotomy. Gael Garcia Bernal is really good here, both in those quiet moments outside the ring and being that big showy wrestler inside the ring. I think he's really good here and almost playing two different characters entirely.
He's terrific. I've always loved him. I have too. He's great.
Yeah. My big problem is I didn't quite buy the entire wrestling angle of this story. I didn't see the significance of it. I was much more invested in his personal life. So he's living with his mother. The father abandoned the family because he came out as gay, like as a teenager, and the father couldn't deal with it. The father is also married and has kids. And now his character is having an affair with a married man with two kids. And so there's that connection going on. There's a lot of deep psychological stuff going on with the son and mother relationship, with that affair that's happening, with all of this stuff. I was so much more invested in that than I was in the wrestling stuff, which is trying to throw all the significance on what Cassandra, the wrestler, meant for the industry.
Yeah.
And that all feels like an afterthought.
Well, yeah.
And that's unfortunate.
That's where I think I remember having problems. I feel like, you know, it's got the underdog sports movie thing going on. You want to root for them to do the thing. I feel like it had really clunky pacing, if I remember correctly. And it just had typical biopic conventions to the point where it just didn't stand out enough from like the three other movies I probably watched at the festival that were a biopic about a queer person in some way. It just hit like all the same notes that a lot of these movies do, and like nothing wrong with it. It's sweet enough, it was endearing enough, the performance is really good, but I don't remember that movie 8 months after having seen it. Do you think you'll remember much about this movie in 8 months?
Oh no, definitely not. I barely remember movies. Like they have to stand up big time for me to remember them after I've put my thoughts down. So, but that's beside the point for me. But yeah, I didn't quite get the significance of his professional life, but I definitely got the significance of his personal life and how much he had to go through to just do anything, like just to keep going in this career and to be himself. That struggle was much more interesting than the Lucha Libre circuit stuff.
Yeah, I just remember like it having, you know, montages, and I was just rolling my eyes. I'm like, yeah, it just feels like the narrative arc is already set and you just kind of follow it. And you're right, the personal doesn't really connect with the professional in the way that you want it to, besides the like dual personality thing that like is at the start of it. I feel like it just doesn't feel like there's enough tension in the narrative for it to be like a movie that I remembered. It was just like, yeah, I remember thinking it was a good performance. Like, what else can I say? Good performance in a pretty forgettable festival movie that's a biopic about, you know, it's a real life guy you've never heard of in the space of the Lucha Libre wrestling world. So if that sounds like you might like it, you might like it. But I don't know. Even Mark agrees. It's missing something, right?
Yeah, it's definitely missing something, some kind of connective tissue there, I think. And the whole thing is sort of summed up by this talk show appearance, and that feels really cheap just to say, hey, this is why Cassandra's story is important. And that's just a cheap little gimmick. If it was really that important, you would have shown it to us the entire movie instead of just throwing it in at the end.
Right on. I'm sticking with my 2.5 on Cassandra.
I am right there with you. 2.5.
Wow. Beautiful. Beautiful synchronicity.
There we go.
I think we're going to agree again when we talk about, or I'm not sure actually. I think so. Carpet Cowboys, a new documentary that I'm going to say misses the forest for the trees, I think, in how it depicts what's going on. Here's the trailer.
There is no other industry that is centered in the nucleus of one geographic location that has so much influence on the world.
This industry is really put together by a bunch of North Georgia hillbillies and half of them getting a regular ride.
That's my favorite.
This is billions and billions and billions of dollars of flooring materials that you don't even think of. It is the canvas on which all the other art rests.
I did this. This is carpet. That's carpet, okay?
I was so intrigued, Mark, with the premise on paper of a movie about like the town in the world that in the US that makes all like most of the carpet that goes all out over the world that is, you know, the Vegas casino carpet floors. I was so interested to learn about the process of that and how the carpet gets everywhere and why this town became the carpet capital of the world. But this movie, decidedly uninterested in any of that, which I thought it was about. And instead, it focuses on this one guy in a way that feels like they're making fun of him for the most part, even though you could argue, like, I see what they're going for. And I love the idea of like an examination of the American dream and how it's unattainable, you know, even in cowboy country. Like, this guy's from Sweden and he moved here to be a cowboy and sell carpet or whatever the fuck. And he can't do that anymore. But yeah, the movie gets hung up in this, like, just following this guy around. And like, it really feels like you're just gawking at him in a way that I didn't really appreciate. And I just, again, I think the movie just got lost in what it was supposed to, maybe it was always supposed to be about that guy. That's fine. But it didn't work for me. Where are you on this?
Yeah, I don't know if the filmmakers got invested and enamored with this guy, Roger James. He's a Scottish expat, I believe.
I think I said Swedish. I meant Scottish.
I think you did. Right. Yeah, Scott. He's from Scotland. He came to Dalton, Georgia, and made like, you know, a good living designing carpets and selling them to all these different factories. And then all the factories kind of got consolidated into corporate interests. So all the mom and pop factories and shops got shut out. And it starts off talking to a bunch of different people in Dalton and who work in the industry or who worked in the industry and have moved on because of the way things are changing.
Yeah.
But then it focuses entirely on him. And you're right. Missing the forest for the trees is exactly what this is. This is a story of how corporate interests take over these industries that we don't think about, and just people lose jobs, they lose livelihoods, they lose companies that have been in their families for generations, and they don't know what to do with themselves anymore. And that's a fascinating story. That's a story we can all relate to and we all need to hear. But instead, it's just about this Scottish cowboy who turns out to be sort of a hustler and just making his way through everything. I don't know if it's making fun of him or if it's just observing him or if it's also, I don't know if it's criticizing him by the end either for what he ends up doing, because it's so hard to gauge what the movie's opinion on anything is after a certain point. Once it drops the entire theme of it, which is corporate America screws up everything for everybody who tries to get by in the American dream, it just becomes about him, and I don't know anymore what it's about. He's a fascinating character. He is. I you gotta admire the gumption. Like, this guy's designing carpets, and he's writing jingles for this guy, this kid who did something on Shark Tank.
The relationship.
It's such a weird thing.
The relationship with the subject and his buddy who writes the jingle is the most interesting part of the fucking movie. I want to know more about those guys.
Yeah, that's a weird one because they're they cohabitate together and they write music together. And the one guy really seems connected. The roommate seems very connected to the cowboy, but we don't know why. And is that another thing that he's hiding from us? We don't know. He's putting on a show. And I think the filmmakers got too caught up in the show and missed the point of what the movie they were trying to make. It's still interesting. All of those elements of the American Dream and how this town has kind of collapsed from what it used to be, they're still interesting. And that guy is interesting. And seeing him go through all of that stuff, I was kind of invested in it. I'm just still like, there's such a better story there. And you had it. You had that story.
Yeah.
And then you lost it.
Yeah. You know, late stage capitalism, masculinity, loneliness, all these interesting ideas that didn't really come through. I hear there's a similar movie called Jasper Mall about a dying shopping mall that actually does all those things better than this movie. A friend recommended it when I said I was watching this. So maybe I'll look up that movie. But yeah, I walked away pretty disappointed with Carpet Cowboys. I didn't know if it was worth the investment. I ended up going with 2 stars for Carpet Cowboys.
Yeah, slightly more generous 2.5, just because I get what they're trying to do. Just follow through on it. Don't get sidetracked by the guy who looks really cool and sounds weird and does some interesting things throughout it.
Classic German March documentaries thing where the directors get distracted by something along the way, and then that becomes the movie. Unbelievable. All right, that was the week of Friday, September 15th. Read more at markreviewsmovies.com for almost, you know, double the amount of, in fact, yes, double the amount of movies. You can get another 6 movies at markreviewsmovies.com for this week. We will hopefully be back next week, but we're in the question mark era of my baby will probably drop. That's how I'm talking about it. Like it's a new album. The baby is going to drop before the next episode for sure. So who knows what life will look like on the other side. I have already watched several movies for next week, and I have several screeners for next week, and I'm probably not going to care to go see Expendables 4 next week, but I think I'll have plenty to talk about. We'll see where we're at.
Yeah. Next episode might be a little choppy if we decide to record. We might see us wearing different clothes if we still watch it on YouTube.
Yeah.
Which you should, because then you can see how we change throughout the week or don't change. Maybe that's the...
we might just record in little bursts because that seems manageable. But yeah, I feel like I will definitely have plenty of time to, presumably, to watch stuff at home. So I feel like next week, what do we got? A new Spy Kids movie? Something called Barber that I don't know if it's worth my time. Flora and Son just showed up on the Apple TV screener site. The new John Carney. I love John Carney. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah, there's already some stuff. I saw Stop Making Sense in IMAX.
I'm so jealous of you.
The live premiere thing that, this week. But that opens, I believe, next week in IMAX, and then the week after in not IMAX. Definitely, this is my... I should say it now because I don't know when I will. Stop Making Sense. Go see it. New 4K restoration, new Atmos Dolby sound mix. It sounds incredible. It looks incredible. It was a transcendent experience to watch on the biggest screen in New York City. It was incredible. Definitely go see that. And Jawan, a movie that's in the top 5 at the box office, Bollywood movie, post RRR. I feel like a lot of Bollywood's getting even more attention. Jawan is another, what's that guy's name? The guy who was in Pathan. His name is Khan. He did this movie as well. It's playing in IMAX in New York and presumably regular theaters elsewhere. I really enjoyed that. If you're into Bollywood, go see Jawan. Shah Rukh Khan plays 2 roles in it. It is batshit crazy. That's my random recommendations of things I watched, not for the podcast this week. And maybe see you later. Until then, Alien Ant Farm.
The show starts in 1.
I don't think I can go on.
Dylan's up. Shut up. Ugh.